superheroes ruled the silver screen this summer. Well, the Green Hornet came out in January, but then came Thor, X-Men First Class, Captain America is still to come, and just over the weekend, Green Lantern.
I, Hal Jordan, do solemnly swear to pledge allegiance to a lantern that I got from a dying purple alien in a swamp, to infinity and beyond, by the power of Grayskull.
What the hell? Come on, if you can find me 100 miles into the middle of nowhere, you think that you can go?
Ryan Reynolds learning to charge the Emerald Gladiator's power ring. If you don't know the difference between Green Lantern, Green Hornet, and Green Arrow, what draws you to see these movies? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Glenn Weldon is with us here in Studio 3A to talk about what he calls the current glut of superhero films. He blogs about comics for NPR's pop culture blog, Monkey See. He's also a panelist on NPR's pop culture Happy Hour podcast. Nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Always great to be here, Neil.
And I suspect it would not be much of a challenge to ask you to recite the actual oath.
Do you want me to? I seriously could. No. I could also do the Golden Age version if you want.
The Golden Age version. That's let's leave that to the imagination.
Good.
In any case, in your review of the film, you quote the star Ryan Reynolds, who says, "This is the movie fans want to see." And you also say that's the problem with the movie.
Exactly. I grew up with this lore. I internalized it at a very young age. So to me, it seems like Civil War history. Take that for what it's worth.
Yeah.
What happens is that you take this, all this mythology about the 3,600 space cops that patrol the universe, lorded over by tiny blue immortals. And when you transpose it directly, comics and movies are different media. Mm-hmm. When you transpose it directly and just simply upsize it without deepening it, I came out of this film thinking, this thing that I love is kind of hokey.
Well,
it's kind of flimsy and thin.
I think you're speaking for all of 2814.
Yeah, thank you. Nicely done, Neil.
Yeah, so as we look at this transposition, this is also a product of sort of second-tier characters. This is not Batman. This is not Superman. The success of Iron Man has given us, in a sense, Green Lantern.
Absolutely. This is a second-tier character. He doesn't have a lot of name recognition. But that's the other thing that happens. When you take a second-tier character, you could go bad in one of two directions. You can either impose a Hollywood three-act summer blockbuster formula over it, the way that bad movies like Daredevil and Elektra did, that felt very formulaic and stilted, or you can cater to the fans, which is a mistake because we're going to see the thing anyway. You got your hooks in us already. Don't worry about us. And we're a fractious bunch. We can't really agree on what we like about the thing. We just know that we like it.
Well, we're going to come out disagreeing with something because we have to find something to disagree
with.
And, of course, the lore will not be perfectly transposed, or at least not perfectly, to each of our individual memories of this. As you point out, decades of backstory.
That's right. And you have to cram all that into one hour and a half, or in this case, it felt longer, but it was an hour and 45 minutes. The stuff that is expanded but not deepened, not rounded, motivations of these characters, which work perfectly well in the comic, just don't work on the big screen. Dialogue that seems stirring comes off as silly. It's just a different beast.
There are different approaches, as you say. There were a successful run of X-Men movies, and this summer we've had X-Men First Class, which is a prequel to the three that we saw before, but in that sense it gets to introduce a whole set of characters again, and it gives us an opportunity to get some of that precious backstory.
My stage name is Angel. Kind of fits. You can fly?
I'm going to be Banshee.
Why do you want to be named after a wailing spirit?
You might want to cover your ears.
Good stuff.
Yeah, and that's I thought X-Men First Class worked better, certainly, than Green Lantern, because it's grounded by two performances by James McAvoy and especially Michael Fassbender, whose role consists of just sort of waving his arms around and looking pained to move things around, but he does it he's so charismatic, you can't take your eyes off him. I thought some of the stuff with the younger X-Men that was played for laughs didn't really work as well, and the tone was all over the place. But it was a stylish film, and kind of knew what it was.
And then there is a separate approach, and this is not to a comic book character, as you pointed out in your review, but one who's been in comic books and is not dissimilar, and that is the Green Hornet. And this is Seth Rogen's adaptation. Here he is talking to his sidekick.
We'll need a car.
Hells yes, we'll need a car.
With strong weapons.
Mm.
And armor.
Cool rims. Spinning rims.
I can do that.
Kato, I want you to take my hand. I want you to come with me on this adventure.
I'll go with you, but I don't want to touch you.
And this is a separate approach, a much more individualistic approach.
Right. That's basically, it feels like a sequel to Pineapple Express. It's very much a Seth Rogen film that happens to be a superhero film. So your patience for the character of Seth Rogen, who he's on screen pretty much the entire film and never
almost every
stops
darn second.
Talking.
No, never stopped talking.
No, so, yeah, it won't change your mind about Green Hornet, but it might change your mind about Seth Rogen.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. If you're not a fanboy, why do you go see these movies? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. We'll start with Jason. Jason is with us from Portland.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
I think it's important to remember when we talk about the appeal of these movies that the most popular genre during the Great Depression was westerns. Because it was sort of this mythos of America where opportunity was around every corner, and it was escapist entertainment for people who were suffering. And now when we look forward at, or today, at the Great Recession, I think it's interesting to note that these superhero characters are almost uniformly average individuals who are somehow given great power and great ability to affect events around them. And I think a lot of people in society right now are feeling powerless, and that's why I think there's that big of a draw.
That's a good point. A lot of these characters that started out this whole thing, Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, have a primal, simple appeal. They appeal to wish fulfillment in a very basic way. Green Lantern, he's not as easily to reduce to a simple tagline to kind of sum him up as easily, and I think that might be why there's a more complicated relationship with him.
Jason, thanks very much for the call.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
As he pointed out, a lot of them are, Steve Rogers coming up in Captain America, typical scrawny kid who's kicked, I'm sure, I don't know if he gets sand kicked in his face at the beach, but we'd like to think so in memory of Jack LaLanne. But in any case, he becomes a super soldier. There is another movie out, though, which is distinctly not about a sort of average guy who gets superpowers, but about a god who is sort of reduced to human levels. This, of course, Thor, who is, just too arrogant, even for his father, Odin.
You are unworthy of these realms, unworthy of your title! You're unworthy! I now take from you your power, the name of my father, and his father before, I own it!
And cast out he is, of course, to Midgard, or that's where we live, actually.
Yeah, I love
it's also
that.
Sector 2814.
That's right, exactly. Tying it up nicely.
Yeah.
I love that clip because that's what the film's about. The film is about Anthony Hopkins chewing the scenery through his big, burly beard. It's just so much fun. It's light. You've got two stars, Natalie Portman and Chris Hemsworth, both of whom are easy on the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And, the story is not just mythical. It's a myth. He's a god, for God's sake. So it's very simple. But a lot of fun.
Let's go next to, Jody. And Jody's with us from Jackson, Michigan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I'm a 40-year-old woman, and I really have never read a comic book in my life. But I've kind of been watching a lot of these movies lately, especially since Redbox has made it fairly easy to rent a movie for a dollar. The main reasons, one is if there's a major actor who I like their acting. They're usually in decent movies. Second, I think it's very interesting the CGI, the special effects that they have today, to see the blend between, you know, what would a comic book would be or what acting would be and what a computer can do now. It's amazing when you compare to, you know, movies of even just the 90s.
Which ones have you liked, Jody?
I really liked Green Hornet, actually. I didn't think I would like it, but I ended up Especially liking that one. And let's see, the I'm drawing a blank here. RoboCop. Not RoboCop.
Iron Man?
Oh, thank you, thank you. Yes, Iron Man. I liked Iron Man 1 and 2. They are both great actors, and one of the third reasons why I am kind of drawn to them is because they've got a different twist, usually. They're somewhat formulaic, but you can almost expect there to be something different, whether like Seth Rogen, he was kind of a jerk, you know, and I wasn't really expecting that. So anyway. Those are the reasons.
And as Glenn pointed out, stayed a jerk all the way through the movie.
Pretty much.
Yeah, he's not transformed by his his experience as a crime fighter. Anyway, Jody, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. And as she points out, name actors, Anthony Hopkins, Robert Downey Jr. in the Iron Man movies.
Yeah, that's a way of kind of taking this material and giving it some gravitas and some depth and making people care about it.
We're talking with Glenn Weldon, who blogs about comics for NPR's pop culture blog Monkey See and a panelist on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. His latest review, Green Lantern, A Hero's Light Shuttered by Clutter. You can read that at npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go next to, this is Taylor. Taylor with us from Augusta, Georgia.
Hey, how are y'all?
Good, thanks.
That's good. Y'all, actually, I was actually going to ask a question, but y'all kind of made the point. I've always noticed that comic book movies, superhero movies, or even action movies in general are usually reflective of, you know, what's going on, I guess, geopolitically within the United States, because obviously these are American-made movies, you know. During times of war, I have seen that, you know, people want a hero, and the movies will put out hero movies that, you know, kind of feed that need or whatever. Whereas, you know, immediately after tragedy, those kind of violent, heroic movies kind of tend to die away because people want, you know, to be placated, so to speak. You know, a lot of good movies right after September 11th went under the radar because they were kind of violent. Whereas, you know, 2-3 years later, there's that need for the hero. Well, people want to have that hero.
And one of the things about comic book violence is that you don't really have to take it all too seriously since nobody else does either.
Absolutely. And you'll have a chance to test your theory very soon with Captain America coming out. That has high name recognition, so you're going to get some people in the theater who actually
have
heard
of him. Not a second-tier character.
It's not really, no. And the thing that I think it's going to make it fun, even if the film turns out to be bad, is that he's fighting one of the three things you want to fight if you're a superhero. You want to fight either robots, apes, or Nazis. And, you know, put a Nazi in your film and punch him, and you got instant appeal.
Instant appeal. I was wondering, though, and thanks very much for the call, Taylor. This is set in the World War II era, where the original Captain America was fighting Nazis, and, well, it turns out the Red Skull is involved here, too, I'm sure. But do they do the iceberg thing at the end, where he freezes and cryogenically reappears back in 1980s America?
Well, he's scheduled to be in the Avengers film, so I'm guessing yes.
And Thor, isolated up there in the Kingdom of the Gods, stranded from his girlfriend. Is the Rainbow Bridge going to be repaired in time for him to come back and join the Avengers, do you think?
I think Joss Whedon will have an answer for you very soon.
And, there's other questions. This idea of joining the Avengers, because now there's going to be an Avengers movie. There's going to be Iron Man 3 is also going to come out. This is an enormous billion-dollar project at this point.
It's all logistics. But it's kind of what Marvel fans look to the Marvel books for. They love that shared universe. It's something that DC isn't bothering with. They've made the announcement that the Superman and the Batman films are never going to cross over, and I don't think the Green Lantern film will either.
they give us a hint of a sequel at the end of it. I don't want to spoil anything, but a character named Sinestro is not always going to turn out to be a good guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's unclear after $55 million take at the box office this weekend that they're going to be a Green Lantern 2.
Yeah, certainly. I think they're sort of running out of characters they can give this treatment to. I don't think we're going to see a Matter Eater Lad film. Do you know Matter Eater Lad?
I'm not familiar with Matter Eater Lad.
He eats matter. That's
really?
His thing.
Yeah.
Go figure.
What happens Never mind. Here's an email from Laura in Blacksburg, Virginia. I watch superhero movies even though I'm not a comic book fan because the movies are what I call big, dumb fun. Mm-hmm. They don't require a lot of thought from me. I don't have a plot to follow, really. And there are usually lots of explosions, perfect watching when my brain is tired and I just want some entertainment.
Yep. This might be a semantic distinction that I make in my brain only, but I love goofy. That's what I kind of love about superheroes, their goofiness. There's a distinction between that and silly, which just seems flimsy.
And it can, as you point out, look really... There's that element of what I used to call cosmic stupidity in comic books, which I loved. Thor seemed to capture it. Mm-hmm. I thought that grandeur was thrilling. Not so much in Green Lantern, where, as you point out, the big villain is a cloud.
Is a cloud. And that worked for Burt Lancaster in The Rainmaker, but it probably won't work for a superhero. You need something to punch.
Hal Smith in Edmond, Oklahoma writes, "Bah humbug. I like the first two Batmans, endured Spider-Man. I hated all the others, unless you count Avatar as being countable in the genre."
Well, I wouldn't.
No,
I really wouldn't.
No, very different.
This genre, it is a subsection. It's a subgenre of action movies. And it's here for the foreseeable future. It's just... I'm just kind of curious who they're going to dig out of the closet next.
Curious also, it is a subgenre of comic books. The capes, as they're known in the trade, there's a lot of other comic books that don't have superpowers.
Well, there have been a lot of films made from comics that people don't know came from comics. Films like Road to Perdition and several others.
But Ghost Story, yeah.
Yeah, Ghost Story, absolutely, yeah.
So keep an eye out for some of those, too. Some of those are a little more quirky than, mm-hmm. Something about in Brightest Day and in Blackest Night.
Mm-hmm.
Quillen Weldon blogs about comics for NPR's pop culture blog, Monkey See. And as we mentioned, he's also a panelist on NPR's pop culture Happy Hour podcast. You can find those all at npr.org. He joined us today in Studio 3A. Glenn, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.
The Emmy Awards are months away, but right now is a crucial time for the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. Members have until Friday to make their picks for Emmy nominations. That means TV critics and bloggers are burning up their keyboards, hoping to build support for their Emmy favorites. Eric Deggans is a TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times, and he's taken time out from his keyboard to chat with us. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm interested to know what performances you think are Emmy-worthy. There are tons of eligible actors in each of the awards, 40 or 60 in a category. Are they trying to boil it down now to 5 nominees? That's right?
Yes. There's plenty of people who we expect to be recognized. Steve Carell will probably get a nomination for his final season on The Office. We expect that Hugh Laurie from House might get nominated because this might be his second-to-last season on House, and he's never actually won one. He's been nominated a lot. We expect Jon Hamm from Mad Men to get nominated. But I feel like there's some people who don't get quite so much attention who we might also want to take a look at.
So beyond the obvious, is there an actress you like?
Most definitely. I think one of the interesting things that's happening with the actress category is that a lot of great actresses are actually nominated in the supporting categories. Regina King from Southland, who plays this great female detective.
Stole the show.
She almost stole the show, and I have no idea why she was nominated as a supporting actress, other than perhaps they figure there might be a little less competition there. But we also had Kelly MacDonald from Boardwalk Empire. She played this great Irish immigrant housewife who becomes a girlfriend to a mobster in training. Condi Alexander from Tremé, you know, she did a great job. But my real favorite is Margot Martindale from Justified. She plays the matriarch of a drug-dealing family in rural Kentucky, and we've got this great clip of her telling off one of her rivals during a parlay, as they call it.
Aside from money, what is business but contracts and agreements? You and me, we had an agreement. I gave up my family's claim on this county, but for one thing. The pot business.
That is true, Mags, but then your son Dickie approached me.
You didn't shake hands with Dickie, you shook hands with me. We had a deal and you broke it.
She sounds like someone you don't want to mess with.
Oh, you gotta love her. And TV fans will recognize the actress. She was on Dexter, but here she gets to play a crime kingpin in Kentucky, and she does an amazing job with it.
Are there actors that you're also talking about?
Oh, yeah. Well, I loved Andrew Lincoln in The Walking Dead. He is actually a British actor who played a southern sheriff who winds up stuck in this world where zombies come to life. Aziz Ansari on Parks and Recreation, he plays a really wacky character who's sort of like your ultimate office mate gone bad. And Nick Offerman, who's also on that show, plays sort of the head of the department with an awesome mustache and an even awesomer taste for being really politically incorrect. I just love his character. But I gotta give it to Peter Dinklage on Game of Thrones. He's the dwarf son of a powerful lord in this sort of medieval Lord of the Rings type drama on HBO. It just concluded on Sunday, and we've got this clip of him coaching the misfit son of another powerful family about how to handle being an outcast in this world.
Let me give you some advice, bastard. Never forget what you are. The rest of the world will not. Wear it like armor, and it can never be used to hurt you.
He's just an amazing character. And now that it's all aired, if you have HBO, you can probably go back and see all the episodes on demand.
When are these Emmy nominations announced?
The nominations are announced on July 14th, and then we'll see the winners announced in September.
Eric Deggans, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Eric Deggans of the St. Petersburg Times. He watches TV, so we don't have to.
This is NPR News.
And now we check in with the new editor-in-chief of one of the country's top magazines for women, Essence. Constance C.R. White brings more than 20 years of journalism and business experience, building her own unique style at the New York Times, Elle Magazine, and even eBay. She's here to tell us how she'll influence the mission and tone of Essence. And she'll talk about the magazine's latest issue, the first produced under her supervision. It features, among other things, the first published piece by music superstar Beyoncé Knowles. And Constance C.R. White, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations to you.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you. And it's very exciting to be here.
Now, you officially started on March 21st, but the July issue is the first issue, would you put it this way, in which you're sort of putting your stamp as editor-in-chief. Would that be accurate?
It would be. It's the first issue where I've really sort of gotten my hands really dirty, and we'll evolve over the next few issues for it to be a total new direction in some ways.
I want to quote from your first editor's letter, which appears in the July issue. It's titled, My Promise to You.
Okay.
I'll just read a couple of lines. I'm sure you could read it. Would you have it in a magazine in front of you?
I don't have it in front of me. I have it in my head.
Oh, okay, but I'm not going to ask you to memorize it. Okay. That would be unfair. You said, this month, as I step into the role of editor-in-chief, I want you to know that I am committed to working with our team to reflect the truth of our lives in words, images, and ideas that uplift and empower rather than confine us and bring us down. I'm promising you that the stories you will read here will be real. Now, you know, what does that mean? Because one of the things that people rely upon Essence to do, as a friend of mine, Alvin Hall, a contributor to this program, says, you know, everybody needs a friend in their lives who will tell them when their breath stinks.
Right.
You know, and Essence is that magazine that often tells African-American women things that they need to hear when perhaps they don't want to hear it from other people. On the other hand, sometimes people do get tired of being told what they could do better. So how are you going to walk that line?
Black women have enough people who are only too ready to say our breath stinks, as you put it. And Essence is that place where we also go to be celebrated, to be affirmed, to be empowered. And while we're not going to shy away from saying, okay, here's an issue that perhaps, okay, maybe we don't have all our stuff right. At the same time, the predominant direction of the magazine is going to be less alarmist and less sort of crisis-driven and really looking at the way that Black women are balancing their lives, being celebrated. I think Essence needs to be that place. And as I point out in that letter, I go on to talk about all the places where in the media we are reflected in such a negative light, you know, one-dimensionally. is the problem. So where is that place where we see our whole selves? Essence is and will be that place.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Constance C.R. White. She is the new editor-in-chief of Essence magazine. Let's talk about what readers can look forward to in the latest issue. The cover story was written. Please tell me it really was written. And was it as told to, dictated into the tape recorder by
Beyonce? No, that was something I said absolutely to my editors. We do not want, and as told to. If Beyonce is going to write this story as she, you know, said she wanted to, then let's have her write the story. So this is a first-time exclusive for any publication. You know, we really see her sharing herself with our readers as opposed to having on that celebrity mask.
You know, another article that stands out for me is titled Women of the Diaspora, Sisters Who Are Commanding the World Stage. And there is this quite remarkable picture of Unity Dow, who is
amazing?
The first female judge on Botswana's High Court. And she's wearing the traditional Anglican regalia of the judiciary, the powdered wig.
The wig.
That was
it's awesome.
Quite impressive. Right. How did you find these women?
As soon as my hiring was announced, I started hearing from a lot of women. And one of the things a lot of them said is, we want to hear about our Black sisters around the world. So we set out, and this is going to be a regular feature, to find those women who are really making an impact on their society and just who really reflect the lives of real Black women here, too.
And there's another, Edna Lima, who's Brazil's first female master in Capoeira, which is the, tell us what it is. I know it if I see it, but I don't know how to describe it.
Capoeira is a combination of art form and defense, which became popular. It was brought over by Africans who came to Brazil, many of them as slaves hundreds of years ago. And it was developed as a way to fool the ruling class. You know, you're learning to fight, but at the same time, you're masking it in an art form, almost like dance.
Okay, Constance, I have a question for you. I've always wanted to ask you this.
Yes.
What does
to wear?
No. What does the CR stand for?
Oh, the CR.
Your byline has always been Constance C.R. White, which is very distinguished. But what does the CR stand for?
The C is for Charmaine, as I like to say, and the R is for Rosalind.
What do you mean you like to say? Because did you make that up? Is it really that? Is that or isn't that? What is it really,
it
like Carly Rechter or something?
I know. As I like to say. No, it is. It is my given name.
Constance C.R. White is the new editor-in-chief of Essence magazine. She was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Nominations for this year's Primetime Emmy Awards closed today. TV networks have been waging slick ad campaigns on behalf of their shows, actors, and actresses. And this year there is a newcomer to the Emmy campaign. The Spanish-language network Telemundo is seeking to become the first Spanish network to win a Primetime Emmy. Telemundo is promoting its hit, The Queen of the South, in Spanish, La Reina del Sur. NPR's Kerry Khan is here to check my Spanish pronunciation.
La Reina del Sur chronicles the life of a naive Mexican woman who falls in love with a drug lord and stumbles into becoming one of the world's most powerful traffickers. In the season opener, up-and-coming narco Teresa Mendoza, played by Mexican-born actress Kate del Castillo, runs from ruthless drug thugs and aqua blue stiletto heels. Through the next 62 episodes, the show is shot in four different countries with multiple casts and in high definition.
The quality of the production was amazing, definitely.
Martha Sarabia is the entertainment reporter for LA's La Opinión newspaper.
You usually don't see that kind of quality, especially all that money that was put into making it.
Especially on Spanish-language TV's nightly lineup of telenovelas or soap operas. Telemundo's high-priced gamble paid off. La Reina del Sur was the biggest hit in the network's history, and the season finale last month even beat out English-language networks in all the major markets. Telemundo's vice president of entertainment, Joshua Mintz, says the ratings were phenomenal and deserving of an Emmy.
It's a series that hooked
millions of people for 62 episodes, night after night after night. And I don't know any other product in general market, in our, you know, in American television that have done that.
But while La Reina del Sur played well with Spanish-speaking audiences and even had some crossover appeal, the bulk of the voters in the Television Academy don't speak Spanish, and getting them to give it a chance is a tough task. But despite the obstacles, senior editor for The Hollywood Reporter, Alex Ben Block, says the Emmy campaign is money well spent by Telemundo.
Because they want to get the word out about the amazing growth of the network and the tremendous growth of the Spanish language programming in the United States. And this is as much about marketing as it is about winning.
Telemundo mailed out 5,000 DVDs with English subtitles, placed ads in trade papers, and held screenings in L.A. Actress and part-time nurse Julia Lippard liked the show, especially that the lead character was a strong woman.
I actually enjoyed the fact that she didn't just lay over and die or just be like, oh my gosh, I can't do anything.
It was the action-packed suspense that won over Peter Pasco. He's also an actor and a voting member.
I think it's nice. Like it's kind of like Weeds meets 24.
The show's lead actress, Kate del Castillo, actually had a recurring role on Showtime's hit Weeds. She played Pilar, a fiery Mexican crime figure. Del Castillo says she's not worried about getting typecast. She says there was so much more to the lead character, Teresa, in La Reina del Sur.
She makes the wrong decisions, she makes mistakes, she contradicts herself, she smokes pot, she sleeps around, she sleeps with married men, she drinks tequila, and people love her.
Del Castillo says she never worked so hard or has been so proud of her work and the show's phenomenal ratings. She says an Emmy nomination would be even more amazing.
I would just be more humble and thankful and grateful for doing what I love and what is my passion and taking it to another level.
But she says she's practical, too, and realizes the chances of her name alongside frontrunners Kira Sedgwick, Kathy Bates, and Juliana Margulies is a long shot. Carrie Kahn, NPR News.